The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson. And this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Heritage Drinks of Myanmar is a beautiful new coffee table book by Australian brewer, academic and writer Luke Corbin, who lived in Myanmar from 2016 to 2021. It takes the reader on an anthropological journey, showcasing 14 different alcoholic drinks unique to Myanmar, comprising beers, wines, and spirits that are in integral parts of village economies. While working on this book, Luke was employed as a brewer at Burbert Brewery in the capital, Yangon. Luke talked extensively about that experience on the Radio Brews News podcast in 2019, and I've linked to that episode from the show notes. Drinks Adventures picks up the story in 2020. As Luke shares some of the setbacks he faced while trying to complete his book, as Myanmar grappled with COVID-19, and then in February 2021, a military coup. Luke joins us from Chiang Mai in Thailand, where he's now based. And there's a link in the show notes to purchase your copy of Heritage Drinks of Myanmar.
When the COVID-19 pandemic broke out, it was just after a huge craft beer festival. The first craft beer festival to ever be put on in Myanmar took place. That was in January 2020, and that was a huge undertaking. I organized most of that. We got 32 beers, 24 taps, and 8 breweries participating. And this is in a country where you're not allowed to import beer. So we actually flew out several brewers from regional breweries in Southeast Asia to brew at our premises and then come out for the festival and put on their beers. And that was a huge success. And that also coincided with the Burbert Brewery, which is the brewery in Myanmar, reaching even. So they weren't losing money anymore, right before COVID. Of course, COVID-19 threw all of that into disarray. And then, you know, there were varying regulations over the next year. But what really turned things around was the military coup, which took place on the 1st of February 2021. So the thing to understand about Myanmar is it's had military rule for a very long time. And there was basically a period of about 10 years, roughly 2010 to 2021, when things got a little bit easier for Burmese people, but also for foreigners. So quite a lot of new businesses popped up in that time, including this brewery. Now, the coup, the main impacts that it had were simple ones in the sense that millions of people went to the streets, lots of people were shot, arrested. There's bombs in the city every day. People are still being assassinated every day. It's hard to move around. All these kinds of, you know, really basic logistical things that you don't think about when you're in a safe and secure country. So the brewery is continuing, but it's not really the place that I want to be right now. Things are better than they've ever been since the beginning of the pandemic. So things are getting slightly better, in the sense that people are more comfortable coming to the brewery and there is less political violence in the economic capital, Yangon, than there has been since February 2021. But yeah, it's still not great. There are plans in the works to try to export our beers to Thailand. But again, that's been a challenge because of the regulations and the border closures with COVID, the periodic border closures and things. But yeah, that's kind of the hope on the horizon, is to try and get into these export markets, because the domestic market is not what everybody thought it would be, unfortunately.
Because there's now obviously an absence of tourism. Was it going to be reliant on tourism at all?
Well, the economy is devastated and the average person just doesn't have the money to spend anymore on, frankly, more expensive beer, which is what we were doing. We were doing, you know, craft beer, to put it simply. And in Myanmar, that was advertised as premium beer because it's very difficult to translate craft. So it's already kind of pegged at a slightly higher aspirational middle class kind of, you know, image. So that is what's really been hollowed out by the economic devastation that the coup has engendered. So the people who are drinking our beer in Myanmar now are people who are already rich and are still going to be rich during the coup, basically. And a lot of people have lost their savings. A lot of people have fled the country. It's going to take a long time for the domestic market to get back anywhere near it was. Now, the silver lining of all of this is that the weird, quirky thing that's still hard to understand the total overall impact of is that a lot of the beer that was sold in Myanmar before the coup was actually military-owned. So a lot of beer is being boycotted inside Myanmar, and we've picked up some customers from that. But again, those beers are not expensive beer. You know, they're very cheap kinds of beers. So there's been a little bit of bleed through from people boycotting military beer and moving to our beer, but most of those people have gone to Carlsberg and Heineken because they're the same price as the military beer.
I read that you had government sponsorship for this book that you've written. Maybe you could tell me how that came about and what the coup has meant for that arrangement.
So the book's genesis, I guess, has three kind of points. The first one is my own personal interest. I was already living in Myanmar, and I was the book being Heritage Drinks of Myanmar that we're talking about. I was already living in Myanmar. I was already doing this kind of research, working at the brewery. So I was already interested.
When you say you were already doing that kind of research, you started to think about, well, I'm a craft brewer in Myanmar. What are the brewing traditions and so forth that already exist here?
Yeah, and the owner of the brewery was really interested in that and really enjoyed having a sort of pet anthropologist who was willing to go out into the villages and have a look at what was going on. You know, I grew up backpacking around Southeast Asia, and Asia is how I ended up in the end doing this. So I was very comfortable and very happy to do that. I like trying new things. So then the next point before we get to the government is Pernod Ricard, which is, you know, the second largest wine and spirits company in the world. They entered the Myanmar market, and they're interested in researching, doing sort of baseline research in a lot of these emerging markets that they go into. So I met up with them, and they were interested in sponsoring some of my research. And then the third point was the National League for Democracy government, who were also very keen on getting involved. They gave me a mandate to improve the hygiene of village and country distillers and drink makers. They gave me research permission, a lot of paperwork to go around into areas because, as I've hinted at, it's not necessarily easy to go to certain places in Myanmar because there are a lot of different militias, ethnic armed organizations, then the National Army as well that control different pockets of territory. So it's a lot of checkpoints involved. And even at the very top of the NLD, so Dor Aung San Suu Kyi was also personally interested in the project. And all of these people who were elected MPs through legitimate elections at the time that I undertook the research for this book, they're all now, with the exception of a couple, in prison or under house arrest or have actually been killed. So I didn't get the opportunity, you know, the gratification. They didn't get to see this book, but Dor Aung San Suu Kyi personally requested the manuscript before the book was put to, you know, photographs and layout and stuff. So I hope that the manuscript got circulated a little bit before the, you know, the unexpected coup that kind of ruined so much in the country.
You didn't get any feedback from her?
No, she's a very busy woman, and that was in the lead up.
Yeah.
It was in the lead up to the elections of 2020, which were held in the middle of COVID-19. So that was a pretty crazy time, even before the military decided to get involved.
So you basically had to regroup and work out how you were still going to make this project happen in the absence of having that government support.
Yeah, and Pernod Ricard were very good about it because obviously they were thrown into the middle of this pickle as well. So the publisher ceased to exist. My Myanmar publisher closed their operations, so I had to move the whole book's production to Thailand. Fortunately, Silkworm Books, which is a very well-known and old publishing house in Chiang Mai, Thailand, they were interested. It helped that I had a full book all laid out with all of the photos and all of the text ready to go. So they quickly snapped it up and, yeah, it was printed the end of last year. I think it went on sale in February of this year. And one of the people from the Central Executive Committee of the National League for Democracy has been let out of prison, but I haven't had any contact with him. One day, you know, my dream is to be able to go back to Myanmar with copies of my book and not only give it to these, you know, head honchos, but to actually go back to the places where I did the field research for this book and give copies of the book to the people who are photographed in it, who actually make these drinks. I really hope that that can happen.
When did you realise how extensive these traditions were and the range of different drinks that they had been made in Myanmar over so many years?
Well, I suppose at the beginning it was intuitive in the sense that, you know, I'd travelled quite a lot and I knew that just about everywhere in Asia in particular has got these kinds of traditions. So I knew that there would be something like that in Myanmar. But I didn't know, quite how diverse it would be. But this is the calling card of the country, right? This is part of the reason why Myanmar has had so many political problems. It's the diversity. There are so many different people. There are so many languages and there's so much tradition there. So it stands to reason that there's this incredible diversity in drinks, and that's exactly the way that it was. You know, there are very few groups of people in Myanmar that don't have some kind of alcohol heritage drink tradition, and very few that have had them interrupted. There are some places where things got a bit curvy with Christianity, for example, in Chin State, which is in northwest Myanmar. Some of those villages completely now are, you know, prohibited by the village chief from making alcohol. But then if you go to another village, they're really into making grape wine now. Now, both that prohibition and the grape wine thing were brought about by missionaries, but just different kinds of missionaries. So, you know, you have a few things like that. And then some areas have become more Buddhist, more pious over the years, and they've substituted their traditional alcoholic brews with green tea, you know, at ritual events and stuff. So they used to have their rice beer at weddings, but now they drink green tea. So there's a little bit of that kind of thing. But for the most part, especially when you put it in a comparative context, you know, compared to the rest of Southeast Asia and all of China, it's a very, very traditional kind of modus operandi there. And that was one motivation of the book project. It's a really, you know, basic one, but they call it salvage ethnography. It's, you know, it's just writing things down before they change, basically. Like, things were changing quickly in Myanmar, especially in those 10 years. You could see how the villages were getting depopulated. Everybody was moving to the cities. The young people wanted to drink industrial alcohol. They wanted to drink brands. They didn't want to drink grandma's, you know, soggy sorghum beer. So it was sort of an imperative to get out there and take photos and write about this stuff without even going the extra step of talking about, you know, the why and the how.
I'm fortunate to have travelled to Myanmar, I should say, probably 8 or 9 years ago now, I think, and didn't come across any of these drinks. So I assume you have to really go looking for them and get off the beaten track in a way that I wouldn't have in a 2-week trip over there.
Yeah, they're not really incorporated into the tourist pathways at all. The only exception to that is there's a few tour guides around the ancient temple capital, Bagan, who take people out to try tangi. And this is a tree sap wine, which is kind of similar to the stuff that you get in India. It used to be called arak by the British, wherever they went during a colonial period. Yeah, so apart from that, just not going to see it. And that was a dream of the Burbert Brewery as well, was to set up something like Heritage Drinks of Myanmar, TripAdvisor, you know, rotating kind of drinks night that people would know about. So when they visited the country, they could just come to the brewery and get this introduction. Because, you know, tourists do the same thing. They come to the big city, they spend a few days, they learn some stuff, then they go out into the countryside and they, you know, enjoy everything else. So it would have been great to have been able to set something like that up, which was a plan after the book. So people like your fine self would have had that opportunity.
Well, let's run through some of the different styles of drinks. You say that the beer, wine and spirits are all part of these traditions, but beer is the predominant one, I gather.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that sort of disappointed Pernod Ricard because, you know, they're very proud that they don't own any breweries, although I think technically they've kind of got an interest in one brewery by accident and they're a wine and spirits company.
Yeah, in Ireland I think they own a brewery that they bought purely so they could age Jameson whiskey in barrels that have previously held beer from this brewery.
That sounds about right, yeah. When I was told about it, something like that. I was like, okay. So it's not secret knowledge that in a lot of the markets that they're in, which is pretty much every market on earth, they're trying to get people off beer and onto wine and spirits. So this book kind of flew in the face of that. But beers are the most common simply because that's the way it goes in human history. Wines and beers are the simplest drinks to make. Distillation is a whole other step. And that was a technology that was perfected much later when it comes to the evolution of human society. And beer in particular, so brewing from grains and tubers, is very much part of agricultural cycles wherever you go. So all of these peasants and people across Myanmar, they're all growing their crops and they're all making beer from their crops. And then some of them are distilling as well. And then some do wine with, you know, all kinds of fruit. So I mentioned the grape, which is not traditional at all, but other stuff that goes back further is quinces. Quince wine is a big thing. And this kind of fruit that grows near rhododendrons, like in the high altitude of Chin State, is also one that I didn't get to because it was the wrong season when I was there. It was very alluring, but I didn't get to see them actually make it, unfortunately. Yeah, so regarding the beers, there's sorghum beer, there's millet beer, there's rice beer, there's mixtures of them all. A lot of brewers are very practical and they make their beer from whatever they have. That doesn't mean that they're undiscerning, that they don't know the difference. They all know the difference in texture and smell and taste, depending which grains they're using. And they have different names for all of those drinks. They're often quite flexible. One of the main motivations of this book is that I mentioned the diversity of Myanmar before. The thing is that there is a sort of national dominant culture and there is a national dominant language. And these are the Myanmar people, the Burma people, and the Burmese language. And in that language, there's one word, Khong Yi. And Khong Yi gets used to refer to all traditional drinks. It's a kind of blanket country liquor term. And so most of the people in Myanmar, they just think all those drinks are Khong Yi. They don't know the differences. Now, all these drinks, as in the book, have different names, different histories. They're used for different rituals, different ingredients. But for the average consumer in Myanmar, it's just all the same stuff. It's all under the same term. So one of the motivations of this book was to try to get Burmese people to be aware and be proud of this diverse history. And this is part of a project that lots of people are doing, scholars, politicians, which is simply trying to point out that, you know, there's unity in diversity. You know, being diverse doesn't mean that doesn't have to lead to conflict. So that's one point about this book. And it was written for a Burmese audience in the Burmese language and the English language. So if I was writing this book in a different way, if I was completely fresh off the boat and I didn't have these connections with the brewery and with the government there, and I was writing for a more natural audience, you know, it would be something more like the sort of craft beer history books that are written by Americans and stuff. And there'd be a bit of adventure in there and I'd be on my four-wheel drive zooming around and stuff. But that's not the way that this book was written. It had a more sort of national motivation to it.
Well, what are the brewing techniques that are being practiced and the sort of equipment that's being used and the people who are actually making these drinks?
So regarding the people first, easiest thing to say is that it's nearly always women. And we know about the history of beer in Europe, right? This has been written about quite a lot. Beer brewing was traditionally a female task. It's associated with cooking. It's associated with the household. That's very much the case across Myanmar. Even distilling as well is mostly done by women. Only a couple of occasions did we find men involved. The way that it's mostly done is through gelatinizing the grains. So we didn't come across any malting at all. What people do is they boil their rice, their sorghum, their millet, they spread it out on a mat, usually a reed mat, and then they apply their yeast and then they bundle it all up somehow, and often in a clay pot, sometimes in gourds, like calabash gourds, and they ferment their grains that way. And then sometimes they'll filter it, but usually they won't. They'll use the straw as a filter. That's a technology that has been around for millennia. And you see straws as filters right across Africa, in the Middle East and everything. So they do that. And it's quite interesting seeing photographs of people drinking really seriously old drinks that haven't been changed for thousands of years. And it looks the same, you know, in southern parts of Africa to Southeast Asia. But that's what they do. The distilling methods are pretty rudimentary, pretty basic. Some people have bigger, you know, operations than others, but there's nothing fancy there. And the wine also mostly is done in a solid way. So they'll pick up the fruit, they'll stab it a bunch of times, put it in a pot, cover it up, you know, put lots of them in a pot, cover it up and wait several months, this kind of thing. So in terms of technical process, it's pretty basic stuff, which stands to reason. But if you think about the social and the cultural significance of everything that they're doing, it's pretty intricate. You know, there's an incredible number of taboos involved. Often to do with menstruation, to do with widows, to do with hunting and men's, you know, masculinity and virility and stuff like that. And all these things, depending on the culture, don't mix in certain ways. And if someone does this, then that means that they won't be able to be successful when they go out to get a carcass next time and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of really deep cultural stuff that's going on behind what appears to be a pretty straightforward set of sequences. Now, of course, I could identify how basic a lot of these processes were because I was already brewing. And if you don't have that, I guess, scientific background to it, then it is a little bit mysterious, you know, the way that yeast works. If we remember before Pasteur and before a couple of centuries ago, when people started to understand that yeast was a microorganism and that it was actually eating sugar, we had all kinds of wacky theories about what was going on. Often it was considered divine, and it's still considered very mysterious by most of the people inside Myanmar. With that said, some have started buying Chinese manufactured yeast. Only a few, but it was starting to happen when they'd foregone their kind of family yeast strains. And the yeast is fascinating. A lot of people there said, yeah, we don't know where this yeast came from. You know, got it from my parents, who got it from their parents, who got it from their parents. They just keep the strain going along in these little huts out the back, just full of yeast cakes dangling from the roof. Sometimes they smoke them because they think that that does something. Sometimes some of them say, oh, you should never use the yeast cakes when they get moldy. And other people say, you should definitely use the yeast cakes when they get moldy. That's really good.
What sort of strength are these beers and, you know, how do they present in the glass? Is it a glass? What's the drinking vessel? How are they consumed?
So usually the beers are drunk out of clay pots or bamboo pots and using reed straw. That's the standard way.
A communal pot, like between a few people? Yep.
Usually communal pot, 100% right. And again, a lot of rules about how to drink, depending where you are. But, you know, there's only so many variations there can be on drinking out of a pot, right, and passing it around. There was one beer in northern Qin State which was stored and kept in a dry format. So usually what people would do is with these rice beers, they would prepare them and then drink them immediately because they go bad quite quickly. That's the downside, right, of delicious fresh beer. But in one household, they developed a way where they kept the beer in a sort of semi-solid state in these gourds that they'd been using for decades. And it kind of was acted as a preservative, something about the microbiological mix of stuff in those gourds. They said that it only worked in the gourds. It didn't work if you use plastic pots and things like that. And anytime anybody wanted to drink it, they just scooped it out, mixed it with water, left it for a bit, and then it got you drunk. So that was pretty interesting. And that person was starting to sell their beer. And what did that mean? It meant that they sold, you know, plastic bags full of porridge that people would take to their own house and then mix with water and then drink. So I found that particularly interesting because I'd never seen anything like that before. Generally speaking, you will find that the beers are more social drinks and the distilled drinks are more kind of potent. So, for example, distilled drinks are often used when people die and stuff like that. Like a shot of the whiskey is put with their body, these kinds of things. They're not as communal, obviously, because they're a lot more higher alcohol strength. So to that question, the beers, they're all very weak. Depends at which point in the fermentation cycle you know, drink them. You have to drink a lot of it. And in the course of this book, I had to drink a lot, often in the morning, because I'm most productive in the morning. So, and also people brew in the morning. So I would get there bright and early and bushy-tailed. And then the hospitality is a huge part of it. So you can't say no. And of course, you know, people are giving up their time and all of that. So,
and were you warmly welcomed in this pursuit when you went to visit these people?
Extremely warmly welcomed, yep, because foreigners don't get out to these places. So a lot of the time the only foreigners people see are development types, people who might work for NGOs and come and visit for a couple of days or just pass through or something like that. So, yeah, there was a lot of interest, a lot of, you know, not confusion, surprise, when people heard about my project. And then, yeah, people really got on board and were extremely generous and showed, you know, more than I could have ever expected. And often I ended up sleeping in their houses because it's not easy, again, like I said, to get to these places and there's only hotels in the cities and so on. So, yeah, a lot of really amazing memories from that point of view. It was terrific.
And I assume you must speak Burmese, but that would have only gotten you so far with some of these communities.
Yeah, exactly. So my Burmese is probably of a standard that, you know, if everybody spoke Burmese, I could have done it without any assistance, but that's not the case. I had the great help of a co-researcher, Burmese co-researcher, and also a photographer as well. So we were a three-person team, and we traveled for 6.5 weeks, just did it all in one shot because that fitted our individual schedules. And then we also, of course, had to hire the services of people who spoke the languages in the areas that we were going to. So there was often, you know, there were tiers to it. We'd often pick someone up in a town, a local, who knew what was going on, who we met through networks, and then they'd direct us out to a village somewhere, and then we'd meet people in the village, and then, yeah, we'd go through this sort of translation stepping stones down. All of the notes were taken, written in a notepad, and also audio recorded, and I've still got all of that, which is really good.
And so were these drinks produced commercially, or are they mainly sort of produced just for consumption by the family and you know, their close contacts?
So most of the ones that we encountered are not sold. Some are sold in a very, very limited area. And then in the cities, you come across, you know, entrepreneurial types who very much want to sell their drinks. So that was a real theme. People were constantly talking to me about, oh, you know, I want to sell my auntie's sapi, you know. We know that this has value and we want to generate business. Unfortunately, none of those have really come to fruition in a big way. And part of that is to do with the political upheaval in Myanmar. There are some very limited sort of arrangements whereby one restaurant in one of the big cities like Yangon will have a relationship directly with an auntie in a village who will send them that drink, you know, once a month or once, something like that. So it is possible to get some of the more well-known drinks at particular restaurants in the big cities of Myanmar, but it's a very, very small operation. And there's no domestic brands for traditional drinks, basically. The closest you can get to it is in the far north, where there's a bit of a crossover between distilled drinks and, you know, medicinal drinks. So there's a strong culture of infusing whiskies with all kinds of things up there, you know, scorpions for this, snakes for that, bees for this, etc. And some of those have been going for so long that it kind of rationalized into brands, but it's still pretty tenuous. You wouldn't call it industrial capitalism or anything like that.
Did you sample all of those creations for the purpose of this book?
Yeah, I did. I sampled a lot of them. I sampled all of them and I took samples of a lot of them. So when I drove the Ford Ranger back to Yangon at the end of all this, I had a huge array of samples. And the plan was to dish all of these out at the book launch. Of course, life had other plans. Most of those samples are still in Yangon. I mean, all my stuff is packed up and still in Yangon. So the distilled ones will be fine still. People have been living in the house where all my stuff is. I don't even know what's going to be there. I had maybe 6 or 7 bottles of Ballantines. I'm pretty sure they'll be gone. Anyway, well, one day we'll find out.
What do the drinks taste like? You know, I mean, starting with the beers, maybe, you know, you're a brewer yourself. Were there familiar flavors there that had you kind of thinking about what type of yeast, for example, could be in those yeast cultures that have just sort of been handed down from generation to generation?
Maybe out there is somebody with the technical prowess to be able to do that, but I couldn't figure out anything regarding the yeast. The base ingredients, the grists, of course, are identifiable and make a huge difference. What would I say the most common flavors were? You know, a kind of apple and coconut come through quite a lot. All of the drinks are pretty thick and chewy compared to barley beer as we used to drink it in Australia and elsewhere. They're very rarely carbonated, nearly always flat, often drunk warm. So that's another factor that makes it a bit different. Generally, it's all about a balance between acidity and sweetness. You know, nearly all the drinks don't have any ingredients that provide bitterness. So you're always dealing with a balance between alcohol sweetness, grain sweetness, and acidity. So generally speaking, they're chewy, they have varying acidity, they're quite sweet. You get this sort of apple, coconut, marshmallow kind of thing. The millet beers are quite thick and the sorghum beers are thicker. They're thicker than the rice beers. Sometimes people mix it up though. Like they do 50% sorghum, 50% rice to find exactly what they, you know, go for. There's different colours as well. So sometimes people are brewing with red varieties of rice or even purple varieties of rice and millet, red millet and yellow millet. So that also changes the hue. But as I've mentioned, they're never served in glass, so you don't really see that so much. The wines, I haven't talked about this yet. I mentioned it earlier, Tan Yi. So Tan Yi is kind of like the main traditional drink of the majority Burmese people in the country. And that's the toddy that's made from the sap from the palm. And that one has an incredibly short life cycle. So that's harvested at like 5 a.m. in big pots of sap. They come down, they ferment, and they're ready to drink by about 10. And then they're kind of rank, you know, by mid-afternoon. So if you drink it at the very beginning, it's super sweet. It's super sparkling. If you drink it at the very end, it's just vinegar. It's just disgusting. And there's always, you know, chunks and insects are attracted to it and stuff like that. And that's the way that this is drunk. There's been no effort to preserve this drink. It is a sort of work in the fields in the morning and then relax and drink your Tan Yi lunchtime.
And it's already fermented in that time or?
Exactly right.
Right.
It naturally wild ferments as soon as it's put into these pots and taken down from the tree and left on the ground. It takes off and it froths up.
You would have kind of tasted it when it's unfermented and also fermented and just kind of noticed what does it just sort of get lightly tart kind of thing at first.
Yep, exactly. And it's got quite an arresting aroma. You know, quite pungent, kind of sulfury, kind of flowery. For me, like it's best, I don't know, 2/3 of the way through or something, you know, because at the beginning it's just too sweet and then at the end it's obviously too rank. And there are like some, like that particular drink gets distributed around like local shops and stuff quite a lot in that area. They call it the dry zone, which is the central part of Myanmar. Yeah, so another one that is getting a bit of a name for itself is called Sapi, and this is a rice beer that's made in the far north, Kachin State, and that one is using a purple rice. And that one's kind of a bit more delicate than the rest, something to do with the rice, I'm not sure. It's just a bit crisper. That was my experience of it, and probably my favorite, maybe from a, if you're going to smash some beers and, you know, eat some fried meat kind of arrangement. Ultimately, this was not a completely representative book, you know, 6.5 weeks, we didn't get everywhere. And because we did it in one go, we heard a lot about drinks that were not being made at that time because they're seasonal and they're based on fruits that just weren't fruiting at that point. So it'd be great to be able to go back and do it all again. But
I read about a very unusual sounding concoction, a rice spirit infusion flavoured with herbs from a mole's den. Maybe you could tell us about that one.
Yeah, that's Pue Ayet. So Pue is the name of the animal and Ayet is the Burmese term for spirit. Yeah, that's a weird one. So basically a lot of herbs are valued for what are considered medicinal properties and are infused into whiskey. And in one part of the country, they made a shortcut method where they noticed that this mole collects a lot of the same herbs that they put in their whiskey, takes it back to its den, its burrow. And so instead of going around through the forest trying to collect the same ones and competing with the mole, people there worked out that they can just find the mole nest and destroy its home and rip it all out and put that detritus in the whiskey. And that's what people have been doing for years. When they rip the stuff out of the earth, it's already kind of deteriorated a little bit, biodegraded a little bit. So it's kind of like wet and soft and quite red. So when it goes into the whiskey goes like quite a beautiful colour, quite a dark red. And you'd never know that, you know, you just look at it, you go, oh, yeah, there's people putting some bark in their whiskey again or whatever. But actually, no, there's an interesting story behind that. It's an interspecies kind of competition. And then, of course, the humans get the upper hand, as we always do, over the rest of Earth species, yeah.
So are these traditions, you know, in danger of disappearing?
Good question. A lot of these populations, so a significant number of the places that I went to for this book, have now been torched by the military, and the people who are in the book, photographed in the book, have fled. A lot of them are refugees or they're internally displaced people. So a lot of the places are never going to be the same as when I visited. With that said, they'd already experienced war, you know, in years past. So there's this tension there. Okay, how devastating is the war that has happened since the coup? And how much of these traditions are kind of predicated on resilience and the fact that people have put up with this for a long time and they're used to running and they're used to hiding, they're used to conflict. So if you're in this situation where people actually never genuinely get co-opted into the markets that we're used to, and the kids that go to the cities to drink the branded liquor then go back to the countryside to pick up an assault rifle, I think that there is some resilience in these traditions, but not necessarily for the right reasons, right? People are very proud of their identity and their identity in the face of national homogeneity and of the dominant majority culture fighting them. And the way that they view it is it's an existential war. They want more autonomy. So good question. Don't know. There's arguments to be made in both directions about the effects of the last couple of years since the research for this book was done. But if you're looking at the long view, I don't see how Myanmar is going to be different to anywhere else. Most of these are going to disappear, and the ones that are remembered and retained are going to be the lucky ones. And I hope that there's a lot of them. Projects like this book are part of trying to, you know, ameliorate that and trying to get people to be proud. Because the other thing we haven't mentioned here is that if you strip away all of this political stuff, Myanmar's a majority Buddhist country. There's a bit of an ambiguous relationship with alcohol. Although most people drink, although there's plenty of booze around, still technically it's considered something you shouldn't do if you're a good Buddhist. And that's not because alcohol is evil in and of itself. That's because alcohol is an intoxicant. And what intoxicants do is they lead you to the other sins. So there's just this hesitance to take alcohol seriously. This kind of research has never been done. So, yeah, that's part of the reason why this book is sort of important. Or the fact that this book could even exist is because of that. Yeah, and this civilian government was a little bit more open-minded, which was quite exciting. Unfortunately, they're in trouble now.
Mm. Well, Luke, congratulations on the book. It looks absolutely beautiful, some stunning photography to go with your research and your writing. Where can people find it if they want to get hold of a copy?
Yeah, that's a good question again. So it's easy to order from Thailand. That's the easiest thing to do. Cost you $50. But if you want to get it some other way in Australia, people have been ordering it through the normal bookshops, so Angus and Robertson and stuff like that. But they're not stocking it. So if you really want to get it, the easiest way is to order it directly from Silkworm Books, the Thai publisher. They send it out pretty quickly. They package it very well. It's distributed in the United States. It's distributed by University of Washington Press, and they also ship it to Europe at the moment.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, James. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, I look forward to hopefully coming back when I've written another book and chatting about that.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson. Like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.